Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 12th of July. This hour of the program, the Washington Post's ill-fated plan to sell sponsorships of off-the-record salons. It has been called an ethical lapse of monumental proportions. 11 intimate dinners to discuss public policy issues for a fee of up to $25,000. Underwriters were guaranteed a seat at the table with lawmakers, administration officials, think tank experts, business leaders, and the heads of association. This is the newspaper that owes much of its fame to exposing influence peddlers and Washington's pay-to-play culture. The criticism of the Post was withering in the blogosphere, and the Post decided to cancel the plans for the series of policy dinners at the home of Catherine Weymouth, the publisher of the Washington Post. We'll be talking about this ethical lapse and the possibility that there may be others. Could it be? This hour of the program with Jeffrey Dvorkin, executive director of the Organization of News Ombudsmen, Rogers Communications, distinguished visiting chair in journalism, and professor of distinction at Ryerson University in Toronto, co-author of Ethics Guide for Public Radio. He's also taught at Georgetown University in Washington, has taught ethics and journalism at the graduate level, and media advisor for all four Georgetown University student newspapers. He was vice president of news and information at NPR and was NPR's first ombudsman for the listeners, a position that he held for almost 7 years. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Jeffrey. Here's how you get a hold of us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that. That address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Jeffrey, hello.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
What were people thinking when they put this together? It seems like such a blatant ethical lapse.
Well, I think they discovered quite quickly that it didn't play as well as they thought it might, and they withdrew the idea pretty quickly, especially when pretty much everyone on the editorial lines at the Washington Post said they wouldn't participate if they were asked to. I think the issue is this the best journalism money can buy? And obviously it is pretty good journalism. The problem is, who has access to it? Should it be private influences? And this is specifically was about healthcare. So even though this happened over a month ago, it kind of prefigured the fight that's going on around healthcare right now. So it's actually a really interesting case study.
Oh, that's it. How did it prefigure the healthcare debate?
Well, because everyone wanted the healthcare debate to be in public, at least on the editorial lines at the Washington Post. And now the arguments that are raging around the country about the nature of the Obama healthcare proposals, I think is an indication that this was such a hot topic that the idea of inside trading on the whole question of healthcare, as provided supposedly by Washington Post journalists, was really an indicator of how volatile the whole idea of pay for play is, and specifically around healthcare.
Mm-hmm. So, what was the Post supposed to get out of this, Jeffrey?
I think they were going to get some money.
A lot of money, huh?
A lot of money. They were going to get influence. They would make connections between, if the journalists didn't already have them, connections between the journalists and people who were players in the healthcare debate. So I think that there was some potential here for something good to come out of it. But there were apparently too many flaws in the proposal for it to fly.
Right. Well, couldn't they just gather all these people on their own, say, come on over to the Post, let's sit down, have a cup of coffee, and we'll get some stories out of this?
And I think that's what happens in the course of normal events, editorial boards, meetings with the people who write the editorials at newspapers. They're always having these kinds of meetings with significant people in the news. The problem is that they were trying to sell this as access, as private access to Washington Post journalists, and that was the real problem.
Right. And who agreed to attend? Did people pony up money?
Yes, there were a lot of organizations and lobbyists that were quite eager to have access to Washington Post reporters, and they were willing to pay for it. As often happens in Washington, there is a lot of money, power, and influence that gets traded all the time.
Mm-hmm. And who was it who blew the whistle on this? Did it happen through the blogosphere?
It happened through the newsroom. I think there was a leak to one of the bloggers, and that's how it got out. And everyone, sort of ducked and ran for cover as soon as it came out. The person who was responsible for the programs apologized, but I noticed last time I looked that he still had his job. So presumably there was a lot of acknowledgement that this initially might be a good idea. Let's see where it goes. And then when it fell apart, everybody orphaned the whole idea.
And Jeffrey, do you think that this person should still have his job?
Well, that's hard. I don't know if that's for me to say. My sense is that when these things happen, they happen at quite a high level. So I'm sure the person who was organizing this did it with the approval of various higher-ups, but we'll never know for sure who those higher-ups were.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea who came up with the figure? It just seems to me to be extraordinarily high, $25,000 to
well,
come to the...
Well, that's not a lot of money in Washington for this sort of thing. I mean, maybe you and I are in the wrong business. But
I guess.
I think that this kind of trading goes on all the time, as I understand it. Peter Overby, who's one of the best reporters at NPR, has done a lot of work on money, power, and influence in Washington, and he's been doing some fantastic reporting on how the system works. So your listeners, every time they hear a Peter Overby story, should get a better idea of how this works.
All right, I'll listen carefully now that you have said that. Is it, though, something that's unusual for a press operation to do? I can understand it, with pharmaceutical lobbyists or whatever, but this seems to me to be rather unusual, or perhaps it's not, to actually pay people at a publication to get access.
Well, it happens in a variety of ways. Usually it doesn't happen in quite so blatant a way as the Washington Post tried to do it. A lot of news organizations have access to, for various funders and advertisers. The Atlantic magazine does this. NPR does this. But the difference is that, as I know at NPR, whenever funders or underwriters have access to people in the journalistic lines, they're not being told anything that the audience isn't being told at the same time. And I think that in the public broadcasting community at the station level and at the network level, there is access to journalists, and it's done in a very open and direct way. And I think that's the nature of how public broadcasters have often had to raise money. The fact that it's been so successful for public broadcasting has not gone unnoticed by other media organizations. And recently, Craig Whitney at the New York Times said, floated a trial balloon, I think, where he said maybe the New York Times should become more like public radio, and we should be a not-for-profit, and we should have underwriting, and we should have tax write-offs, which I'm sure sent a chill down the spines of fundraisers around the public broadcasting system.
I'm sure.
If NPR is now forced to compete with the New York Times, that's going to change the nature of the journalistic endeavor considerably. So nothing really came of the Craig Whitney suggestion, but my guess is that they're trying to think of ways in which news organizations, which have been struggling terribly over the last number of years, to figure out a way that they can monetize their product in a way that puts them in a more secure place.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that could be a possibility? The New York Times could be funded that way down the road?
My guess is that it won't. But the fact that they're thinking out loud in this way is, to my way of thinking, an indication that journalistic organizations in North America and in other parts of the world are in really serious difficulties. Even the grand old newspaper in London, the Observer, which is the oldest Sunday newspaper in the world, announced that they're in danger of shutting down in October.
Yeah.
This would be a terrible loss for journalism and certainly for the newspaper industry overall. The Observer is a very highly regarded newspaper, but their parent company, which is The Guardian, lost $86 million in the last quarter.
Oh, my gosh. Where are we going to get our news, Jeffrey?
Well, I hope from public radio.
Oh, I know. I hope so, too. Let's talk more about some of those other things that you mentioned. I know the Atlantic magazine having special forums. The Wall Street Journal, I understand, brought together global finance leaders for a two-day conference that was sponsored by NASDAQ and hosted by the top editor and other editors and reporters. The New Yorker has an annual festival featuring its editors and writers, and that's sponsored by American Airlines, Delta, Westin Hotels, the Banana Republic. Do you have ethical questions about all of those events?
Well, I think there's a question about how good is the firewall between the editorial lines and the financial side of a news organization. You may recall, and your listeners may recall, a few years ago, the Los Angeles Times put a supplement when the Staples Center opened in Los Angeles, and it was designed to look as part of the news section of the newspaper.
Mm.
The LA Times got into a lot of criticism for allowing that to happen. But the fact is, they did it because the lines between editorial and the business side of media organizations are getting closer and closer. To a certain extent, it's not a bad thing for journalists to understand what the business realities of a media organization are. The problem is, you know, when you have this supposed arm's-length relationship between who the funders are and what the editorial side is doing, how short does that arm have to be before you're in real danger?
Right.
And I think the more we talk about it and the more the public thinks about it, the more successful these news organizations will be in helping their journalists and the public and the financial side of the organization understand where the distinctions must lie.
I wonder if the Post has lost a bit of its reputation. It has been written that this newspaper that owes much of its fame to exposing influence peddlers and Washington's pay-to-play culture, all of a sudden does this kind of thing, does it undermine their integrity substantially or not?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think the fact that they responded so quickly and with such good ethical instincts to me means that the newspaper still has its, you know, all its marbles, and it still understands that its commitment to as a public service vehicle is still intact. But it's a warning sign for all of us that we have to be very careful about how close we come to the line.
Right. We're going to welcome phone calls for Jeffrey. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Jeffrey Dvorkin is our guest. We're talking about this big controversy. It took place in July, but of course it's pertinent to now, and there are other not perhaps as blatant examples of this invitation that went like this: underwriting opportunity, an evening with the right people can alter the debate. It was a one-page flyer distributed by the Post. Underwrite and participate in this intimate and exclusive Washington Post salon, an off-the-record dinner and discussion at the home of CEO and publisher Catherine Weymouth. Bring your organization's CEO or executive director literally to the table. Interact with key Obama administration and congressional leaders. We'll have to ask Jeffrey whether or not the Obama administration was going to send people to this and had signed up for it. The flyer promised the dinner would be held in an intimate setting with no unseemly conflict between participants. Spirited? Yes. Confrontational? No, it said. And the relaxed setting in the home of the publisher assures it. So we're welcoming your thoughts on all of this. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And the email address is talk@WPR.org. Jeffrey is executive director of the Organization of News Ombudsmen. He's a professor of journalism and also co-author of Ethics Guide for Public Radio, and was the vice president of news and information at NPR and NPR's first ombudsman for the listeners. So that's what we're talking about. Join us. We'd like to hear from you. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we are going to be talking, well, we're going to have a good hour. We never had a chance really to remember Walter Cronkite. He died shortly before I went on vacation, and I loved Walter Cronkite, and I know many of you did. We're going to talk about the kind of journalism, and I actually read his book, A Reporter's Life While on Vacation, which I highly recommend. So Mike Simonson will be joining us, wonderful broadcaster from Superior. You hear him here on National Public Radio. He's won many awards and knew Walter Cronkite, so Mike will be with us. And Christiana Amanpour will also join us the second hour. She has a new documentary, which airs this Thursday, Generation Islam, which I had a chance to see most of last night, and it's an extraordinary piece of work. So we'll talk with Christiane about that coming up the second hour of our program. For you to join this conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Jeffrey, I know that people from the Obama administration were invited to attend this, and this was actually billed as a way to have some access to the administration as well as to the newspaper. How did they respond to all of this? Did anybody say that they were going to show up for the event?
You know, that's an interesting question, because I haven't heard a peep from anyone quoting anyone from the administration saying what their response was. To me, that's an indication that once they saw how fraught the idea was, that they all also headed for the hills. So my guess is that it was probably a good idea to begin with, and when they saw that it wasn't, they decided to abandon it as well. Their political instincts are usually pretty good, so the fact that we haven't heard anything from them about this must be an indication that they're bailing out on this pretty quickly, too.
Right. Let's go to phone calls, 800-486-8655. Derek from Round Lake, Illinois, our first caller. Hi, Derek.
Yes, good morning. Good show. Actually, I would like to give you and guests two examples of actually the censorship, which actually effectively takes place in the press media. Ms. Vivian Schiller, who's actually head of the NPR now, coming from New York Times Online Edition, I was holding on Talk of the Nation for about 12 minutes, which actually I was cue to ask her a question. I was not allowed to, regards of the very non-existent coverage of the crony capitalism in Mexico under Carlos Slim monopolies. And Mr. Slim has actually invested last year $250 million in the New York Times Corporation. And according to my information in Mexico, it's where do you live? He was actually coming around telling that his business is quote-unquote safe because New York Times is his business now. And the second example I'd like to cite is a story I wrote for one of the major Washington newspapers about Ecuador, which actually was there covering the issues. And the story was withdrawn after a very long debate about listing the Chevron Corporation lawsuit for world's largest environmental damage. I've been specifically told off the record that either story goes through without that paragraph mentioning Chevron, or doesn't go at all. And I decided to basically say either the story goes the way it is or doesn't go. So I think readers and listeners have to really be truly aware of the non-existent walls between what journalists are supposed to be and what issues are being covered.
Jeffrey.
Well, I think that your listener raises an interesting point, which is, how far are journalists allowed to go with their own opinions? How much of their reporting is fact-based? To what extent can they draw conclusions based on their own reporting? And at what point does an organization's assumptions about who funds it turn into a kind of self-censorship on the part of journalists? If I was going to do a report for a newspaper where I blamed an oil company for something. I better have some pretty good facts to back me up. Otherwise, it looks like I'm, you know, pounding a bully pulpit for a particular issue. So without knowing all the details of what of the editorial process that your caller went through, my guess is that it's a combination of wanting to make sure that you've got all the facts, but also kind of erring on the side of caution that you don't want to annoy or anger too many important people. And I think that's a real danger now, especially when news organizations are feeling so insecure. Does this mean that news organizations are pulling their punches? They don't want to offend important corporate or financial interests. All of these things need to be discussed openly so we make sure that we're doing the right thing in doing the kind of journalism that the public needs.
Mm-hmm. And the press has been criticized recently for not wanting to anger people who have a great deal of power, people in the administration. It was particularly a criticism of coverage of the war in Iraq, et cetera, that there wasn't enough thorough coverage of whether or not this was a good thing to do, and everybody thought differently after we got involved in this. Is there, do you think, an inclination on the part of many journalists to not want to anger people who are in power?
I think this is a natural reaction. I know that in my time in Washington, that both in the last days of the Clinton administration and during the Bush administration, that there was also a kind of a go-along-to-get-along quality, that if you were too tough on the administration, your access became less assured. This was certainly the case during the Bush administration. They played favorites very openly, and if you were tough or skeptical about the administration's policies, especially on Iraq, then you were basically cut out of the loop. So
right.
My guess is that although the Bush administration did this more vigorously than others, I think this is a fact of life in Washington.
Essentially, you were off the plane for some organizations, right?
That's right. If you were following, especially the vice president, he made it perfectly clear who he wanted on his bus and who he didn't.
Yeah. You talked about journalists and opinion. I wonder, it seems to me as though with the age of the internet and everybody doing blogs and their own columns, that we're seeing a lot more journalists who may be mainstream journalists on the nightly news or doing some kind of, you know, program, and they're blogging, and we're learning a lot more about who they are and the fact that they do have opinions on certain things. Is that
right?
Good?
And I think this is the nature of our journalistic media landscape now, is that you have so-called legacy media, mainstream media, doing what the best it can under these circumstances. But there's a lot of other stuff that's going on the internet and the blogosphere, and it means that there is more opinion journalism being put out there. And I think the danger is that mainstream media will feel tempted to do this as well. Why should the bloggers have all the fun? And it's also cheaper to do, by the way, to have someone go into a to go online on the internet or in a radio studio and give an opinion, as opposed to the time and effort it takes to spend shoe leather out there doing that kind of fact-based reporting. And so there's again that kind of economic pressure to get things more quickly, and in fact what we should be doing is making sure we're getting it right.
Jeffrey Dvorkin, our guest on the Ideas Network, Executive Director of the Organization of News Ombudsmen. Derek, thanks for your call. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, and we go to Tom from Rhinelander. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kathleen. My comment is that, this might be a little late. I think we're in the greatest crisis for our democratic institutions that we've ever been in, and the media is one of the major aspects of that. We've had For example, we've had 50 years of relentless accusations of liberalism in the press. We have organized attacks every time there was anything critical. You know, they had the call-ins and the heads of the organizations calling up and that kind of thing. You've got the death of newspapers. You've got the death of investigative journalism, which has been substantial. And how can you have real journalism without investigative journalism? You have stations that call themselves fair and balanced, which are so far to the right that it's stunning. You have another station that calls itself the most trusted name in news, which is, if you watch it all day, is also tilted to the right. And you have profit has consistently and thoroughly undermined the legitimacy of the press in this country. The question really is now, is there any possibility of pulling back from that horrifying precipice that we're on? And I, for one, am really starting to get very doubtful that we have not lost, the Fourth Estate completely.
Hmm. Where do you go to get news? Tom, you're going to make me cry here. Where do you go to get your news?
Well, I search all over on the internet, uh-huh. and I watch MSNBC because at least there are a few people on there who are willing to talk about issues that no one else does. But I have to read Mother Jones to find out about things that are like Mexico and how completely non-existent the real government is in terms of the war on drugs down there. It's just there are things that it's as if we're in Disneyland and we walk around and we get these nice reports or we get these things that say, oh my, the sidewalk was dirty, but we're not really getting information at all.
Jeffrey.
Well, this is exactly the case, is that investigative reporting is in decline everywhere because it's very expensive to do, and it's very hard when if you're running an assignment desk and a reporter comes to you and says, I need 2 weeks to get this story, and your own deadline is, well, that's very nice, but what can you do for us in the next 2 hours? And that's the problem that journalists are facing now, is that the competition caused by the Internet is really very difficult for all news organizations. So at the same time that the Internet is the enemy, the Internet is also the savior. And news organizations don't know which way to turn. My own sense is that news organizations should be making partnerships with the right bloggers to be the place where the investigative reporting that's being done in the blogosphere can be verified back at the home base. This is, to me, is what's starting to emerge, is that there's a partnership that's being developed in a number of places between citizen journalists and mainstream media. I know that our colleagues at Minnesota Public Radio have created something called public insight journalism, where they are asking the public to help sort out what the issues are, and often they're getting some wonderful results as a consequence of these kinds of partnerships.
And how do they do that? To talk more about this public insight journalism.
Well, it's a great thing that Minnesota Public Radio has done. They've started it a few years ago because the head of Minnesota Public Radio, Bill Kling, said to his staff, every story we do, there's someone out there that knows more about it than we do, and you have to get that person in the story. And so they started using their website to ask people, what do they know about certain issues, whether it's state taxes or education. Their breakthrough story happened a few years ago when Northwest Airlines, which is hubbed in Minneapolis-St. Paul, contracted out all of its maintenance to Costa Rica. And so they asked the public, why is this happening? To make a long story short, the issue wasn't entirely about the economics of contracting out. It was because the state of Minnesota had cut back on technical training to such an extent that there weren't enough people involved in aeronautics to be able to do it inside the state. So it became a story about the nature of education inside the state of Minnesota.
Oh, interesting.
It's been a terrific way for Minnesota Public Radio to connect with the public in a way that shares and expands the journalistic involvement. And I think that's what one of the things your listener was just alluding to, is that we have to figure out new ways that we can do these kind of partnerships.
Yeah. Let's go to some of his comments. And I'm struck by this, too. I'm not sure where all the rhetoric is coming from. I'm frankly appalled by some of the lack of civility that's taken place at the town hall meetings on this crucial issue of health care reform in this country. It goes to the heart of who we are, how we're cared for, how we care for each other, all of that. It's just an important issue that you would think would be discussed in a very civil manner, because we all deal with it. All human beings who live in this country deal with it. And yet we're getting these sort of talking points that are coming up from a lot of people who attend town hall meetings. They become really vicious in many ways, violent in some ways. And I'm wondering what the role of the press, this is kind of off the topic, but it's really bothered me the last few days. Where's everybody getting all these same points, these talks about socialism, everybody says, you know, every now and then you realize people are listening to Rush Limbaugh all the time because they're saying the same thing instead of the nuances of a very complicated conversation. Is the press to blame for the nature of discourse on this issue and others, Jeffrey?
Oh, I think to a certain extent we are. There are four most important words in the journalistic lexicon are, in my opinion, how do we know? And so that in our effort to be fair and balanced, to coin a phrase, we have to be keep both sides
right
on an even keel, etc. And so what we're doing is we're giving sort of equal time and equal legitimacy to both sides of the issue, instead of doing our own reporting, coming to conclusions and saying, you know what, X is right and Y is wrong, and saying it because we've done the reporting on it and we can clear it up. I think this is also an indicator of how thin some of the journalism has become, is that we've allowed people mostly on talk radio and some of the lobby groups to basically start to define what the issues are. I'm now based in Toronto, and so the view from up here is pretty extraordinary, I have to say, because the nature of the healthcare systems, the contrast these days couldn't be greater.
Right. How is the press in Toronto and in Canada treating our debate? Do they think that we're all quite silly, or?
Well, there's a lot of astonishment up here that there isn't more explanatory journalism that's going on to basically to dispel some of the myths and rumors around the strengths of the American healthcare system and the weaknesses, and conversely, how the Canadian healthcare system is being demonized quite frequently.
Yes.
I mean, there are some issues. There's definitely issues around how effective the Canadian healthcare system can be, but those are amplified to the point where everything else gets drowned out. There's a woman from Southern Ontario who's been a spokesperson for how dreadful the Canadian healthcare system is. She claimed to have a brain tumor, but someone did some investigative reporting. She didn't have a brain tumor. She had a cyst. Mm. This is not quite the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, this goes unchallenged, and no one seems to be doing the kind of reporting on this that might be required.
Right. And it is so important, Jeffrey. It's such an important issue.
Boy, is it ever.
Isn't it?
Yeah. When my family and I moved to Toronto, we were just astonished to discover how much healthcare is taken as a matter of course in Canada. The anxieties that people have in the United States just don't exist in Canada.
Right. Thanks, Tom. You got us rolling on a lot of subjects there. Thanks very much for your call. Frank from De Pere is next. Hello, Frank.
Hi. One of your callers suggested that it...
You got your radio on, Frank.
Yeah, I'm going to get in the other room.
All right.
I'm away from the radio now.
Good.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that someone wondered what the function of the newspaper should be right now, and the function is very clear. I'm speaking as a publisher of newspapers for all my adult life, and as a professor of professor of business ethics at St. Norbert College for many years. The obligation of a newspaper is to try and present both sides as clearly and accurately as possible, and give the people a chance to decide on their own. Then if they want to opine, then the appropriate time to do the opinion is on the editorial pages or in letters to the editor. It's pretty clear the parts of a newspaper and what their obligations are. And most of us in the business, I think, recognize that. We still have some darn good newspapers in the state of Wisconsin. The one who's a real giant is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Absolutely.
And as long as we've got some of those people, I think that we don't have to worry all that much about the future of journalism. All the newspapers have fallen on hard times, and it's going to be that way for a while, but they're not going to go away, and they'll still be here generations from now.
Jeffrey.
Well, absolutely. I know Marty Kaiser in Milwaukee, and I have nothing but the greatest respect for him and for the newspaper that he puts out every day. I think that, you know, we can hearken back to what Thomas Jefferson said, that a people cannot be both ignorant and free.
Mm-hmm.
And the role of the media now is so essential, so much more important now than it's ever been, and we have to figure out a way in which we can make sure that the needs of the citizens are served by our media, but to do it in a way that that assumes that these media are able to make a reasonable profit, but that the role is to serve the citizens, to serve the democracy. And that's the challenge that we all face right now. How do we do it? The students at my university at Ryerson in Toronto are seized of this in a way that I can't, is so impressive. I think the journalism students now are much more savvy and entrepreneurial than they've ever been, because the reality is they've got to be. And that gives me some optimism and cause for hope.
Thank you, Frank, for your call. More phone calls for Jeffrey in a moment at 800-486-8655. One line is open. And our email address, should you care to share one of those, is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we're doing something slightly different, splitting the hour into two different topics. We'll remember the life of Walter Cronkite the first half hour, and then Christiana Amanpour, who has a really good documentary that airs this Thursday on CNN, in which she spends quite a bit of time in Afghanistan, in Gaza, and time in Pakistan as well, looking at young people and the hearts and minds, how to win the hearts and minds. Some striking images in this documentary, including one that stays with me today of literally hundreds of school children in the middle of nowhere in Afghanistan who are so hungry for knowledge and are just taking their instruction under the hot, hot sun. So that's coming up the second hour. Let's go back to phone calls. Vivian from Milwaukee is next. Hello, Vivian.
Hi there. Good morning, and
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am tuning in late. But about what the press wants to report or the news, I was at Congresswoman Gwen Moore's presentation of the health care issue.
Oh, were you last night?
No. Uh-huh. Sorry?
Yesterday.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I was there yesterday and at North Division High School. And I was interviewed by a couple of the stations, actually. Not most of things didn't get on. But I'm thinking of one particular station where we were asked, I was talking with someone on the other side, and it's, aren't you upset about all the screaming out here? This was before it. And yes, there were some people that were kind of shouting at each other, but I was having a discussion with somebody on the other side, and we weren't screaming at each other. We both had our voices rather loud, but we still weren't screaming at each other. And when I looked at the what was on the
yes.
you know the web later in the evening, this particular channel had focused the things toward people shouting people down. Now, that was true, but it would have been much better had it been despite some of this. It basically, the information, wonderful information was given. These four points were, and Gwen Moore answered. She had a couple hundred, I think, I'm not sure, questions, and they had distilled six of the main things. And she said, well, this question came in many different forms. Sometimes it was focused this way or that way. It all comes down to the basic issue. She was answering things, and sometimes she would get interrupted, and she'd say, you asked your question, my turn to answer you. If the idea that the emphasis was on the idea that it was a raucous. And I think that at least my particular reporter, who was very kind, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but still I feel she had in her mind that I'm going to make the story, this was a loud meeting. And I think we're not being served by getting out the meat rather than just something that sounds sensational.
What an excellent point, Jeffrey.
Well, absolutely, and I think this is a tremendously important issue, that we have to make sure that our journalism is not reflecting the extremes of a story, but finding a way to illuminate by finding some place, maybe not so far on the outskirts of the story, but somewhere in between. That being balanced on a story doesn't mean choosing the extremes of a story, and this is a critical part of what journalism is supposed to do. And unfortunately, you know, when we're selling the sizzle, not the steak, journalism often ends up doing a disservice by missing the story, by concentrating just on the flashes of light rather than the real substance.
And it's something that's happening on, I watch the nightly news, I've done it all my life, but it was on the nightly news, too, that was the way they framed yesterday's story, and it's the way that a lot of this issue is being framed. Shame on everybody for doing it that way, because as Vivian said, you know, there may be spirited debate, but there was more than, as I mentioned earlier, just a certain kind of talking point. You get the impression that that's how all of these meetings are going, and indeed, there has to be something of substance being said. Does the press think that's boring, or why aren't we getting that?
Well, actually, this is a really interesting point, because a study was done a few years ago by a group called the Committee of Concerned Journalists in Washington, where they analyzed, through the Project for Excellence in Journalism, 34,000 individual supper hour TV news stories to determine what were the elements in the story that kept the audience, what were the elements that the audience wasn't interested in, and what pushed the audience away, and specifically with regard to crime reporting. And the study determined that when you do crime reporting that basically shows flashing police lights and yellow tape without any context or explanation, the audience goes down for those stories. When you put context in the story, even crime reporting, the audience stays with you. So that what they've discovered in this is that, especially in television news and in local television news, if you do stories without context, people don't want to watch it. So I think that this is a good, timely reminder that journalism is all about context and not just about people yelling at each other,
yes,
or flashing police lights.
Right. This is a good time for us to promote our healthcare forum that we are doing because we, as you know, have been taking this issue very seriously. And on Tuesdays for some weeks have been looking at healthcare in other countries. We're doing a major forum on healthcare and the proposals that will be on the table, and the situation I'm sure will change. It's about a month from now, September 16. So those of you who are vitally concerned about the way the press is covering this and concerned about the issue, we've invited all kinds of people from, you know, we're going to talk to nurses and doctors and people from the insurance company and politicians and people who don't have insurance and all of that. It will be at Frederick Hospital, which is based here in Milwaukee, and it's September 16. It is free. It's open to the public, but you need to call to register. There are limited seats, and the way people are turning out for these events, I would think we'll have a huge crowd. So call Katie Madsen and tell her you will be interested. I guarantee you it will be an important and civil discussion. 227-2047 for you to sign up for that event. We would like to see you there. Jeffrey Dvorkin is our guest now, Executive Director of the Organization of News Ombudsmen, and we go to Jim next. Hi, Jim, you're on the air.
Hi. I just have a comment. I don't know if you talked about this, but I don't think journalism, when you present both sides of the story, you've really done any journalism. Any high school kid could go out and collect comments from both sides and write that down. That isn't journalism. For a lot of issues, there's a truth somewhere. For example, when Sarah Palin came out and talked about death committees in the health care plan, it's not journalism to have her
say that. Yeah, your phone is cutting out, but we get the point here that we may be saying, in the interest of balance, we're going to say that here's one side, even though it may not be the truth, Jeffrey.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly the point. Your listener has it exactly right. What people want is context and explanatory journalism. It's, of course, important that both sides be reported, but not necessarily at the extremes of a position. That doesn't serve the interests of the public in any way.
And thank you very much, Jim, for the call. Cheryl from Sauk County. Sauk County, hi, Cheryl.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for this program. You just reminded me of a little anecdote. I was on a school board for a school district in the 80s, and we would have a reporter come from the local newspaper, and she would report the next day in the newspaper what we talked about. And I'd ask her sometimes, were we at the same meeting? Because, you know, it was so different from what I perceived was going on, mm-hmm, and what the most important points were. The reason I called is I think that the baby boomer generation, and I've been told this, I haven't done my own research, baby boomers are going to be the last ones to read literal newspapers anymore. It's when we get to the Gen X and Gen Yers, they don't read newspapers. And so it doesn't surprise me that newspapers are going out of business. And I think they're doomed. I don't think we're going to have newspapers in, I don't know, the very near future. So, you know, I think that's something that we all have to face up to. The other thing that I think is important is that, you know, when someone really has a one-sided view of an issue, it's, for me at least, I try to, especially if my view is the other side, I try to get them to see what the other sides are. But so many people have just one source, you know, it's somebody who is on the far right or the far left, and they won't look at any other sources to try to balance out their own digestion of the news.
Yeah, I think that's very true.
Well, Jeffrey. And I think the problem with a lot of journalism is that we seem to be in the business of providing informational comfort food. We don't want to do anything that's going to upset our audiences. We don't want people to cancel their subscriptions. And I think this is why ombudsmen, if I may throw that one in,
sure,
are actually so useful to make sure that all sides of a story are told, that people are being heard, and that occasionally to make sure that the interests and the concerns of the audience, the listeners, the readers, the viewers, are being held to account, so that an ombudsman has a really vital role of making sure that a news organization is transparent and accountable, and at the same time to help the public understand what are the standards of good journalism and how they should be upheld. So it's that particular balancing act that that ombudsmen provide and do so in a variety of ways. Unfortunately, in the United States, with the financial crisis that news organizations are going through, there are fewer ombuds around today than there were even 10 months ago. But at the same time, the number of ombuds being created in other countries, especially in Latin America and in the Middle East and in Asia, keeps growing. I keep getting requests for people to join the Organization of News Ombudsmen from far-flung places. We just have to do a better job in helping our colleagues in American newspapers and broadcasters understand that this is a vital role that journalism can provide, which is to be an agent for the public inside the organization.
Well, Jeffrey, I'm glad we found you. You were a great guest.
Oh, well, my pleasure.
Yeah, we'll call you again, and I hope you'll say yes.
Anytime.
Okay, thanks, Jeffrey.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
Jeffrey Dvorkin, Executive Director of the Organization of News Ombudsmen. He is the Rogers Communications Distinguished Visiting Chair in Journalism and Professor of Distinction at Ryerson University in Toronto, co-author of Ethics Guide for Public Radio, and was Vice President of News and Information at NPR and also NPR's first ombudsman. For the listeners, a position he held for about 7 years. Well, we covered a lot of territory sometimes. That'll happen during an hour. Stay tuned for our next hour. Something unusual. Walter Cronkite and then Christiana Amanpour will be joining us, so it should be a great hour. Thanks to, everybody for producing this program. And we're going to, actually, Rob Schroeder produced it and Jolema Noel on air production.